Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Burn many things we found. That's the wonderful Dar Williams singing the Solartopia theme song with Pete Seeger, David Burns, and the Rivertown Kids. This is Harvey Wasserman choking on some sushi here, and be glad to back with you. Being glad to be back with you on the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show for another thrilling hour. We have a truly great guest with us today. Paul Geip is one of the world's leaders, if not the leader, in pushing of renewable energy for all our future energy needs, and a real pioneer, especially in the use of the feed-in tariff. Paul, you with us out there in Bakersfield, California?
Indeed, I am, Harvey, and it's good to be with you.
Well, it's good to be with you, and as is our wont on this show for the last few months, I'm going to start with a nuclear update. I usually do that anyway. There's lots to talk about briefly before we get deep into the green world of solar energy, wind, tidal, geothermal, ocean thermal, all those great things with Paul Geip. One of the big pieces of news this week is something that has never happened before, which is a former chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has come out and advocated the shutdown of nuclear power. Gregory Jaczko, who was forced out of his position as the chair of the NRC, has said that, and I'm going to quote here, nuclear safety is, quote, just rolling the dice, and that the nuclear power industry is in such a ramshackle and decrepit mode that nuclear power should be phased out as quickly as possible because regulators can't guarantee against an accident causing widespread land contamination. And Jaczko criticized the commission for two decisions this past week, saying that it damaged its international reputation for upholding safety. I don't know how you could damage the NRC's reputation any more than that. And any more than it's already been damaged, let's put it that way. And Gregory Jaczko, a major figure, I mean, you don't get to be chair of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission without some credential, has basically denounced the industry and cause for a rapid shutdown. We also have an astonishing, I mean, you know, I've been an anti-nuclear guy for 40 years. I couldn't make this one up, okay? At Fukushima, we have spent fuel pools flying in the air. We have one 100 feet high with, about 1,600 tons of the most deadly substances ever to show their face on this surface. This is spent fuel rods from the internal core of nuclear power plants. These are from Unit 4 at Fukushima. That unit did not blow up, but the building itself is in shambles, and this spent fuel pool is 100 feet in the air with totally reliant on a cooling system that's barely holding together. And last week, you heard it here first, folks, a rat, apparently, that's a rodent, apparently ate through the wiring on the electrical system for the cooling functions of the spent fuel pool, without which we would have a spectacularly disastrous accident. And it was upwards of 2 days, I believe, the cooling system was not working on this spent fuel pool. Fortunately, it did not blow. They got the electricity, started to get the electricity back online, or they did get it back online, and then it went out again. And why did it go out? Paul, do you know the answer to that? Paul Geip, do you know why the electrical system went out a second time on the Fukushima?
I can't imagine, Harvey. But what else could go wrong?
Well, what happened was, I could not make this up, folks. Sorry. They were installing a wire mesh around the wires, the electrical wires, to keep the rats away, and they managed to touch a bare wire with the wire mesh, and they shorted the system out. So while protecting the wires from rats that would had eaten through and caused what could have been an apocalyptic release of radiation, the geniuses running these nuclear plants, I call them the atomic idiots, shorted the system out a second time.
Well, you know, Harvey, that's a great segue to talking about renewable energy because, you know, enemies of renewable energy like to show those videos of wind turbines catching fire, and occasionally they've even fallen over. And I remember a presentation by Paul Vossberg many, many years ago. I think it was like in 1983 when his wind turbine had fallen over. He announced to a conference, the bad news is our windmill's fallen over. The good news is we haven't had to evacuate Los Angeles.
Exactly right. And speaking of Los Angeles, and you're in the you and Bakersfield are certainly in the firing line of the San Onofre nuclear plant.
Absolutely.
I'm sure you're following this. I don't know if you're in Southern California Edison's rate district, but they have now applied to reopen San Onofre Unit 2. Now, here's another one you couldn't make up. These geniuses who run the nuclear industry, who've only been installing wind cooling systems in nuclear plants for 50 years, decided to upgrade their cooling system, their turbines, steam generators, rather, at San Onofre Units 2 and 3. Spent $750 million that we know
apparently, of. Apparently, they made a mistake in the computer modeling of the system. That seems pretty basic to me.
Yeah, it's pretty basic stuff. And, you know, it's like you've been working on cars all your life and you misinstall a radiator on an old Volvo. I mean, come on. And so they stuck in these twin generating systems. Oh, they were supposed to be twins, but apparently they're not exactly twin. And very quickly began rattling all over the place. Pinhole leaks developed. Radiation escaped. And they had to shut down, and they've been shut since a year ago, January, both Units 2 and Unit 3. And San Onofre now wants to be opened by its utility owners around June 1st at 70% capacity as opposed to 100%. So they're admitting they can't run the plant at full power, and they want a license to run it for 5 months.
Well, the good news, Harvey, is that Southern California Edison, the owners, not the owners, I think actually we may be the owners of the plant, but anyway, the operators of the San Onofre are up against a very formidable opponent. That's John Geisman. For your listeners who don't know, John Geisman is quite a figure in energy policy in California. He not only was the chair of the California Energy Commission, a longtime commissioner of the California Energy Commission, he personally took on Pacific Gas and Electric, that's our other major investor-owned utility, when they were trying to pull a fast one on the ratepayers of California, and he won. And so I think the good news is that Edison is up against a formidable opponent, and maybe those reactors will stay down.
Yeah, we have a lot of great opponents, too, throughout California, against both San Onofre and the two units at San Luis Obispo, California, the Diablo Canyon units. Everybody, I'm sure, is going to be glad to hear that these four units in California are all very near to major earthquake faults and are both sets of are in tsunami zones.
And, well, what's interesting, Harvey, is that on April 16th, so that's next week, there'll be a number of Germans visiting California to talk about the Energiewende, the energy revolution, I like to translate it as, that's taking place in Germany. And some of these Germans are the architects of the German policy to close all the reactors by 2020. Or
all right, well, Paul, since you've jumped on this, and of course California could very easily, I believe... Now, California has fewer people than Germany, but I think it's bigger than Germany geographically.
That's correct. There's 40 million people in California that we can count, and there's 80-some million in Germany, but Germany is much more densely populated than here because we have the vast Mojave Desert and so on. We're larger than the country of Great Britain.
Well, and so be it. And we have better beaches, too, as a matter of fact. But
a little more sunshine, indeed.
Yes, and more bikinis worn on them. So let's jump into it now, Paul. So we do have this ongoing crisis at San Onofre. We are working very hard to keep them shut. And one of the arguments that people make is that we could do in California what Germany has done or is in the process of doing in terms of converting our energy system. So, Paul, you've been a major follower and even architect of the kinds of policies that have led to this transformation going on in Germany. So, Paul Geip, tell us real quickly your most recent book, so we have your a title out there for you.
Well, that's the most recent book is Wind Energy Basics. That was 2009. There's the version in French, but I don't think that'll be helpful to your listeners. And then there's Wind Power for Home and Business. That's my big book on wind energy. Some 500 pages of all you wanted to know about windmills.
And what's that? What is your website?
Wind-works.org. Again, wind-works.org. But the topics include other forms of renewable energy, thermal, solar, and, of course, renewable energy policy, which is why I'm on the call today.
Good. So let's talk about that. Can you tell us, please, in your own inevitable and unique fashion, Paul Geip, what is happening with Germany, and how could it apply to California in particular and the United States in general?
Well, I think the most important lesson that we can take from what we see happening in Germany, and it's not just Germany, but in this case it's the most the best example that we have at the moment, is that there is a political commitment in Germany to move away from both nuclear power and fossil fuels. A lot of people here in the English-speaking world, particularly in the United States and Canada and Australia, they tend to look at the Germans making a commitment to close their nuclear reactors, and that is certainly significant, not anything to make light of.
Well, let's
they
say,
also
well,
have a commitment.
Paul, just jump in. How many reactors are there in Germany? How many are now shut, and what's the timeline for closing the ones that are still open?
Well, I think there's less than two dozen. I think there's like maybe 15 altogether. It's not something that I keep track of. I look at how much electricity produced, not how many reactors there are. And they've closed to seven or eight. I think there was one that was down for a long-term shutdown, and it closed additional seven after Fukushima. Those were turned off, and then the rest will be turned off. So around another seven or eight will be turned off by 2022. And what's interesting for you, Harvey, is that that had been the original policy in Germany up until about 2010, and then the current government, the Merkel government, had campaigned on relicensing the reactors to operate longer. Unfortunately, the Japanese made some mistakes at the Fukushima, as you discussed, and unlike most political leaders in most other countries who are typically attorneys, I think Mr. Obama is an attorney, for example, Angela Merkel is a physicist. She has a PhD in nuclear physics, and so it's very interesting. She concluded, I'd made a big mistake. That is, trying to extend the life of reactors. They are too dangerous for our people, too dangerous for our political party to regain political power in the future, which is all politicians really are concerned about. She made a decision about face to close those reactors, which, in a way, was just a reiteration of a policy it already had in Germany, but it was a major about-face politically. But what I was getting at, Harvey, is that the Germans also have a commitment to close their fossil-fired plants, to dial back their fossil-fired plants into the future. And that's an important thing to keep in mind as well. And your listeners may not be aware that on this continent, North America, the province of Ontario, the current political leaders in that province came to power in 2003 with a commitment to close their coal-fired power plants, and this year they will close the last coal-fired power plant ahead of schedule. That's the most dramatic, the most progressive carbon abatement, climate change policy in North America, and it's probably the one carbon policy in North America most Americans know nothing about.
Amazing. So the entire province of Canada
and
is going to
the province of Ontario
is going to go without coal.
Yes, in fact, they're almost there now. They just need to close one more plant. They had planned to close them, I think, by 2015, maybe 2017, to move it up to 2015. The last plant will be closed this year. And it's not an insignificant amount of capacity. I mean, if they had one power plant, you say, okay, the Ontarians could close that plant, wouldn't have a big effect. But when this current political party came to power in 2003, the province was getting between 22 and 25% of its electricity from coal-fired generation. Some of the biggest and dirtiest coal-fired power plants in North America were Canadian, were in Ontario, and, well, they're closing them. And I think it's a heck of a good story, and a lot of people should know about that when they say, oh, we can't do it, it's too hard. Well, you know, the Canadians put their pants on the same way we do, and they were able to do
that?
It.
Sorry about that. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
They're doing it.
I mean, are you sure they put their pants on the same way we do? I think those Canadians are pretty weird myself.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
But what are they using to replace the coal capacity that they're shutting down?
Well, they started on a massive renewable energy development program. Two things that happened. One is that...
And you were a part of this, Paul. You were in Toronto. You've been in Toronto quite a bit working for the government there.
Well, I don't say that Harvey, I did not work for the government. I have never really worked for any government. I represent the NGO community. I'm one of those people, like yourself, standing around waving your arms saying, this is what the government should do.
Right.
In a rare case in my career, the government actually paid some attention, and I'm quite proud of that fact. And I think we as Americans really should look to see what Ontario's done, because it's really an amazing success story that many of us are not aware of. And I call what Ontario's been doing the most progressive renewable energy policy in North America. And I hate to say it, over 30 years, not since Jimmy Carter, really. Not since we began building the wind farms here in California back in early 1980s have we seen a policy as aggressive as this in North America. And that's part of this policy of closing the coal plants. Now, to be completely factual here, in 2008, the world came to an end. We had the great financial collapse, the great financial crisis. That forced a closure of a lot of auto manufacturing in the province of Ontario, just as it did in Detroit. And those factories consume a lot of electricity. So the demand for electricity in Ontario has not increased since 2008, and it, in fact, has decreased. It's decreased in part because they launched a conservation program, but it's also decreased in part because of the closure of many factories that once employed tens of thousands of people. And that, of course, has reduced the consumption of electricity, so it makes it easier for Ontario to close their coal-fired power plants, and they're also replacing some of those with natural gas-fired power plants. So the picture is more complex, but the picture is still an encouraging example of what can be done when there's a commitment to do it.
Now, are they doing fracking up there?
Not in Ontario. No, they definitely haven't got to fracking yet.
Good. We like that. Now, let's go back to Germany. Tell us about the shift to green power and the significance of wind and solar. And I, since we're back in Germany, I want to say, before we lose track of this incredible quote, which made its way around the Internet, there was a commentator on Fox News.
And they were, oh, yes, of course.
They were talking to someone like you who was explaining the shift to renewables in Germany. And this Fox News so-called reporter said
so-called expert
was easy for Germany to go to solar energy because they have a lot more sun in Germany than they do in the United States. Would you care to comment on that, Paul Guy?
Oh, I think we should all buy beachfront property in Germany.
Yeah,
absolutely. But bring your rain gear.
Unless they were carrying in from 1941 to 45 when Hitler conquered North Africa, I guess that would count. But go ahead and let's talk about this.
Well, I think one of the things that people need to hear is that Germany currently gets between 21 and 22% of its electricity from renewable energy. Now, a portion of that is old hydro system, but Germany doesn't actually have a lot of old hydro, the existing hydro, like we see on the Columbia River, for example. Only about 4% of their electricity comes from old hydro. In fact, solar photovoltaic, so solar cells, those blue cells you put on your roof to produce electricity, they now produce more electricity in Germany than all the hydroelectric capacity in the country. Over 5% of their electricity is now just produced with solar cells. 7% is produced with wind energy, and another 7 or 8% is produced with biomass and biogas, primarily biogas. So, you know, they have lots of pigs in Germany. Germans like their pigs. And pigs, you know, make a lot of pig shit, and they make electricity with pig shit, just as they do in Denmark. So,
hey, which is better, pig, cow, or chicken for making electricity?
Well, that's good. I would say pig's probably pretty good, because that's the one I've seen the most of, is pig power plants.
Okay.
But you can do it with any biomass material. Just takes different little bits of bugs to do the processing into methane. So
here's a question that's going to come up, Paul. Sorry to keep interrupting you, but I'm going to assume, and this is not really a frivolous question, I'm going to assume that the production of pig manure has less global warming impact than the production of cow manure.
Well, I think that's true, because cows, of course, fart, and farts are global warming gas that's far more potent in the atmosphere than methane. Far more potent than carbon dioxide.
Right, so, and pigs not having four stomachs.
Exactly, they're not ruminants. Yes.
Right, and you know, I have read a significant number of publications indicating that the massive numbers of cows that we raise in this world for beef, which I don't eat, by the way, is a very significant factor in global warming.
It's certainly a contributing factor, and I misspoke. Really, they're burping. They're ungulates, so it's the burping that releases the methane. But anyway, we're not going to
I'm glad you cleared that up.
Okay. We don't want to get confused here. But, you know, another thing that's significant about what the Germans have done is that they have done most of this within a decade. Within 10 years, they have been able to increase the role of renewable energy from about 5% to 22%. And this is a huge accomplishment because, you know, Germany, okay, it's not as big as the United States, but it's like the fourth largest industrial power in the world, the U.S., China, Japan, then Germany. It has 80 million people, and those people produce a lot of fancy machinery, cars and machine tools and so on. So it is a highly industrialized country with a high standard of living. For many of us Americans who travel to Germany, think they have a better standard of living than we do here. But they are able to now, and within 10 years, increase the role of renewable energy. So this is mostly new renewables from about 5% to 22%, and they're going to try to reach between 35 and 38% by 2020, and they stand a good chance of meeting that. And even more significantly, by 2050, they plan to be effectively all their electricity produced with renewable energy.
Wow. So tell us how they're doing this.
Well, they have a policy. Well, let me step back just for a second before I describe this policy. And one of the effects of their development of renewable energy is also quite different than what we see here in the United States and in Canada. And that is, in Germany, the majority of the renewable energy that's being developed, so whether you're talking about those pig power plants or cow power plant or a municipal waste incinerator or wind turbines or solar panels, the majority of those are owned by the people who live in the community. They're owned by people like you, Harvey, and me, and like lots of other people, school teachers, labor leaders, union members, retired people. In fact, in Germany today, a lot of people who are nearing retirement invest in solar energy and wind turbines as an investment for their retirement.
What kind of return do they get?
They get about 5 to 7%. Sometimes less than that, but that's enough. It's beating the inflation rate right now, which is, of course, in the U.S. is only 2%. So how do they do this?
Are those returns tax-free, Paul Grape?
It's not tax-free in Germany. It is tax-free in Britain. Same policy that I'm about to talk about is tax-free in Britain, and that's substantial benefit. So in Germany today, about 51% of all the renewable energies being developed, that's been developed, is owned by the citizens, owned by the people. Now, it's not owned by a municipal utility. not owned by a company like a private company like Pacific Gas and Electric or a municipal utility like Los Angeles Department of Water and Power. It's owned by citizens, by people, by farmers, villagers, and the like, over 51%. So we're talking about $100 billion investment.
That's $100 billion in investment?
$100 billion with a B, yeah. Of investment that's been done by people like us. They own it. It's their renewable resource. And that's one of the reasons why you see renewable energy growing so rapidly in Germany is because common people can invest in the future of for themselves and their children, but also for their country, and make money doing it. And that's what enabled Germany to increase the role of renewable energy so dramatically is this policy that they use, which actually is an IT policy that we invented here in California in early 1980s. But as we've done with so many other things, we threw it out the window and forgot about it.
Well, that's back when Jerry Brown was governor.
That is back when Jerry Brown was governor.
And he was then replaced by George Duke Majan, who was otherwise known as the Grim Reaper, and Ronald Reagan in the White House. They together crushed the growth of the nuclear of the solar power industry back then, putting about 10,000 people out of work, as I recall. And but now we're back in space,
including myself, I might add.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. But the Germans and other Europeans, so we are talking about Germans because that's the most obvious success story to talk about, but this is not just a German phenomenon. But the Germans and the other Europeans took this idea that we developed in the United States and refined it. And we call this policy today feed-in tariff. And simply, it's just like the way we used to regulate electric utilities before this great deregulation fervor, or I would call mania, swept the U.S. and other countries during that Reagan-Thatcher era. And this policy says if you want a certain kind of technology to produce electricity, to have a variable resource base so that your lights stay on and that you have electricity into the future, you have to pay for those different resources, whether you're building a coal plant or a solar power plant on your roof or in your yard or a wind turbine and so on. And so this policy says if you want these technologies, you want windmills, and you want solar panels, then you have to pay for them. It's not a very radical idea, actually. And it says if the windmill costs so much and it takes a certain payment to make that wind turbine cost effective, then that's what we have to pay. If we want solar panels on people's homes, then it costs so much to do so. Then we have to pay so much for the electricity that they produce. This is exactly the same way we used to regulate electric utilities in the United States. So it's nothing radical at all, but that's the policy they use. The shorthand is feed-in tariffs, and that's what they do in Germany, and it's created a revolution because it's not the utilities building power plants. It's the people building power plants. And this is what we need to do here is we need to bring this American idea back to the U.S.
And that's the feed-in tariff, and that basically says that you pay the true cost, well, the true financial cost.
That's right. I'm not talking about any external cost. I'm saying if we as society say we want solar panels or windmills because of the benefits they provide, we internalize those external costs in the decision to have those technologies. We think windmills are good. We think solar panels are good. We think geothermal power plants are good because they don't burn carbon to produce electricity. They're not dangerous. If they fall over, you don't have to evacuate Los Angeles. Then we have to pay what it costs to produce electricity with them and pay a little bit extra, which is the profit that the owner would get. The same way Pacific Gas and Electric, when it builds a gas-fired power plant here in California, it's the same principle in which they get paid. We're just now saying, you, Harvey Wasserman, you get to do this too. It's not just PG&E. It's just not Toledo Power and Light. It's you. You get to do this, or the farmer in Columbus, outside of Columbus, Ohio, or the farmer in Iowa. They get to do this, not just lease their land to Florida Power and Light. They get to build the wind turbine, they get to own it, they get the benefits from it. They also take the risk.
What a concept. We're talking with Paul Guipe, one of the world's leading experts on the conversion of renewable energy to Solartopia, as I like to call it. And, of course, we're at the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. I'm Harvey Wasserman. It's my honor to talk to Paul Guipe, who I've known a couple of years here and there. We're going to take a short break and come right back. Paul, we're going to talk about your article, which I've posted at nukefree.org, and let you talk about your books a little bit, too. So take a short break, and we'll be right back.
Coal plants, new plants, oil refineries, pipelines, mega dams. Iran, Iraq, Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, Kurdistan. Oil spill, meltdown, flooding, suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam.
To get a better plan. We're talking about a better plan. Thank you, Dana Lyons, Cows with Guns fame, singing the Solartopia Rocky Top version. We're here with Paul Guipe, one of the world's leading experts and advocates on the conversion, the actual, tangible, physical, ongoing, very, very profitable and very powerful conversion from what I call King Kong, coal, oil, nukes, and gas, to a completely renewable energy grid. And along that way, Paul Guipe, you have an excellent article, which I've posted at nukefree.org. That's N-U-K-E-F-R-E-E.org. It's in Renewable Energy World, called 100% Renewable Vision Building. Tell us about this. What is the vision which you've done the nuts and bolts work on for so many years of actually doing this conversion to renewables?
Well, it's pretty simple, Harvey. When I first began working in this field of renewable energy...
And when was that? That was back in, like, the 1840s, right?
No, it wasn't another century, that's for sure. It's been a long time. But anyway, when we began this, we actually thought if we ever reached 10% of new renewables, intervariable resources such as wind and solar, that was just an incredible accomplishment. We couldn't anticipate ever reaching 10%. So we would say maybe if we ever had, the technical term is penetration of renewables in electrical system, new renewables in electrical system of 10%, that would be as far as we could imagine. Well, we reached that pretty quickly in some countries. Then those of us working in the technology, and a lot of the engineers were doing the studies about how to integrate renewables, such as wind and solar, into the system, said, well, you know, we can integrate 15 to 20% fairly easily with that much change to the existing system. It would look exactly like the system we have today with some minor modifications. I said, well, okay, so our target then, our estimation of what renewables could do would be 15 to 20%. And in fact, I remember writing in one of my books, I can't tell you which one, I says, we as renewables advocates are never saying we're going to ask for 100% renewable energy. That's not what we're going for, because, well, you need fossil fuels to make up for when the sun doesn't shine or the wind doesn't blow. Well, you know, I was mistaken. The technology and the rapidity with which new renewables are being added to the system has overtaken our advocacy. It's overtaken our expectations of what renewables can actually accomplish. They can do far more than we who early worked in the industry in the early years ever anticipated, ever even imagined. They have exceeded our visions of what could be done, and now people are stepping back and saying, you know, we've done so much, and it's happened so quickly, we can go a lot further than we ever thought. We can go to 100%, and that is the intellectual movement in the renewable energy discussion that we see today, particularly in Europe. We can move towards 100% renewable energy. Just talk to Willett Kempton from the University of Delaware. People may have seen news reports about the study from the University of Delaware. It said the PJM systems, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Maryland, they could get 90% of their electricity from renewable energy, and it wouldn't cost much more than it does today. And that's the kind of thinking that we see now at universities, at research institutes, government organizations that are studying how we can not only get off nuclear, Harvey, but we can also get off coal and also get off of gas.
Well, it's very interesting because I actually just watched a documentary last night about Ray Kurzweil, who's a pioneer in bioengineering and nanotechnology. And he's a big advocate of renewables, among other things. And he explains the acceleration of technology in general as the fact that it's exponential, because when you, as you generate new technology, the new technology speeds up the development of the newer technology. And so what's happened with renewables, obviously, both wind and solar as well as biofuels, is that as the new technology comes available, it accelerates the pace of still newer technology. This is what happened clearly with the internet and continues. I guess it's Moore's law, right, that you double the capacity of your computing capabilities every 2 years.
Well, this is true. And so one of the things, of course, I'm always cautious about this because I deal a lot with technical people, and you're right about this effect that technology has on multiplying other technologies, that effect. But because electricity is such a physical thing, and it's so, the demand for electricity is so huge, we may not see quite the kind of growth that we see with computers. However, I just want to call to mind, Harvey, that when you look at places like Denmark, they now get, that's not tomorrow, but today, they get 28% of their annual electricity needs from wind alone, just wind. If you include those pig farms, those pig power plants I mentioned, they get up to 44% of their electricity today from new renewables. Their objective is 50%, maybe it might even be 52% now. They have a new government, 52% by 2020. They can easily make that. But more significantly, the country of Denmark, a nation of only 5 million people and about 6 million pigs, their goal is by 2030 to have 100% of their electricity from renewables, and much of their heat from renewables. And I think by 2050, I'm kind of forgetting the details, so by 2050, 100% renewable energy in the energy system. So that includes transportation. That's cars,
yes,
and trains and so on. It would all be produced with renewable energy.
Right. God, there's so much to talk about. I mean, part of this, of course, and listeners, don't be confused here. There's two major forms of energy we're talking about. First of all, energy in general, all energy, and secondly, electricity. People like to say, every once in a while you read, well, quite often you read people saying that nuclear power gives us 20% of our energy. That's false. It gives us 20% of our electricity, and that is going down. It's only 8% of our energy.
And this is why, Harvey, in that article that you referred to.
That's your article today at nukefree.org.
Exactly. I make a point of saying that the vision today is no longer just 100% in electricity, but 200%, 300% in electricity if you're going to have enough renewable energy to offset heating and offset transportation. You need a lot more renewably generated electricity or sources of renewable energy to provide heat and transportation than just electricity. So the goal has now gone beyond just 100% electricity to consider 100% renewable energy in heating and transportation. Now, that's a huge intellectual step, and that's where we are today.
Right, and a major player in the conversion in the on the transportation sector is the onrush of electric cars, which you will be able to charge your own car off the solar panels on your own house.
And we have one just up the street here in Bakersfield, and I looked at a Nissan Leaf yesterday.
Yeah, and how to work? Well, expensive a little bit, but
well, no, that's you have to pay for technology, and we're still at the bleeding edge of this technology, and so you have to be willing to make that kind of commitment. But it's the fuel costs are low. There you go.
Yeah, it couldn't be lower. So now also today posted at nukefree.org is, well, and of course the issue of electric cars raises the issue of decentralization, because and just as solar cells are the great enemy of the centralized utility system, electric cars will undermine the gasoline, the fossil fuel industry. Now, there's an article I have published today at nukefree.org. Germany finds a balanced solution for renewable intermittency. Now, one of the big raps against renewables that we keep hearing is that, well, what do you do? This is by Paul Brown. It's posted at Alternet originally, and I reposted it at nukefree.org. Is renewable energy's biggest problem solved? And the subtitle is, German researchers have found a way to overcome one of the problems with renewable energy, the fact that it is not always available, by linking different options in a unified system. So this is an integrated system, which gets rid of, in fact, I was just in a debate the other day with some guy who was advocating fracking and saying that, well, you can't use solar because the sun doesn't shine at night.
Harvey,
that was a really great scientific
yeah, I know, and this is why when people contact me, they say, well, you're a windmill expert, aren't you? And I say, well, yes, I am, but I work with renewable energy. And unlike most advocates of solar, and I'm happy to take a swing at the solar guys, as an advocate of renewable energy, I'm also an advocate of solar, an advocate of geothermal, biomass, and biogas, all forms renewable energy, because if we want to have an integrated system of renewable energy that replaces 100% of our electricity, replaces fossil fuels, replaces nuclear power, then we have to have an integrated system. It's just as though if you lived off the grid, you came to me for advice. Say, what should I buy to help me live off the grid? And I say, well, you need a windmill and a solar panel. Don't just buy the windmill, you need a solar panel. Don't just buy the solar panel, you need a windmill. You need an integrated system. And my colleagues in Europe and my colleagues here in the United States say it looks like you need about 60% of the electricity of the 100%, about 60% of that electricity needs to come from wind, because the wind can blow at night. It can blow in a winter when the sun is not as strong as it would be in the summer. And you need about 40% of that electricity come from the solar panels. And the rest in geothermal and hydro and biomass and biogas, they can add to all that. But that's the kind of proportions. And one of the things, Harvey, that really concerns me about progressives and renewables, so-called advocates in the NGO community, and particularly solar proponents, is they only think of solar. This is really an American problem. Many Americans who look at solar only see solar panels. They don't think of renewable energy. We have to have it all.
Right. So we have to have solar, wind power, geothermal, ocean thermal, biofuels. I'm getting to learn how to say that really fast.
Yeah, you're doing good, Harvey.
Well,
you're doing good.
But number three, the third option generally seems to be biofuels. Can you talk to us a bit about biofuels and maybe even mention that four-letter word hemp here?
Well, biofuels implies to me liquid fuels for transportation. And while I don't have a particular objection to that, I'm more focused on electricity and using electricity in transportation, for example, high-speed rail, using it in public transit systems. Those can be easily electrified. Most urban transit systems are electrified, but also our long-distance rail transit can also be electrified. It hasn't been done in the United States. We're very backward in that regard. And also in personal transportation, private vehicles, I'm more focused on electric vehicles because I think that's where we're going to go. We're not going to meet our needs with biofuels. When I'm talking about biomass and biogas, that's usually to produce electricity. Or in a case of biogas, you can produce high-quality gas that you inject in the pipeline system. So it's definitely not fracking. It's not coming from underground. It's coming from pigs.
Well, and also crops, right? I mean,
we can ferment crops too. Right now, I'm just focused on the waste stream.
Uh huh. Okay, because I think as we end the era, the ridiculous era of the drug war and marijuana prohibition, we are seeing a parallel movement to legalize hemp. In fact, the United States is the only industrial country in the world where hemp is still illegal.
And well, let me go on for a second and talk about how we get to beyond 100%, for example.
Okay.
And a lot of people, when they think the knee-jerk reaction when you think of going to 100% because the wind and the sun are intermittent or variable resources, that you need a lot of battery storage. Well, storage is useful. Storage is helpful, but it's not absolutely necessary. And as I said, I was just talking today to Willett Kemp, a professor of engineering at the University of Delaware, and what he has found, and this has been confirmed in work I've seen others do in the past elsewhere, that if you just have more generating capacity, more wind turbines, more solar panels than you need, there's more capacity there to produce electricity when the wind is not as strong or the sun is not as bright, it's a little cloudy, for example. And that's cheaper to do than building storage. And yes, you might still need some natural gas-fired power plants, but these can be the real cheap kind of natural gas-fired power plants, real cheap, inefficient kind, because you only run them 9 or 10 hours a year, you just don't care.
Very interesting. We're talking with Paul Guype, pioneer in wind, solar, tidal, geothermal, generally in renewable energy. And you did earlier say, well, if you get 60% from wind and 40% from solar and then the rest from other places, you do get to more than 100%.
Yeah.
Now, in this article I've posted at nukefree.org, originally from Alternet, talks about the Fraunhofer Institute for Wind Energy and Energy Systems Technology in Kassel, Germany. Are you familiar with these guys?
I was just there last year.
And so they are working out an integrated system for the German energy grid to...
Actually, I have some notes from my interview there on July 2nd, right here on my desk as you're talking.
So what they're doing is trying to do what you advocate here, which is to integrate wind, solar, biofuels, geothermal, and all that other stuff so that there is no intermittency. Is that correct?
Actually, Harvey, it's fascinating. This thing is sitting on my desk to take action on, and it's from our interview on a visit, a tour by the Ontario Sustainable Energy Association, stopped in Kassel at what used to be called ESET, the Fraunhofer Institute, had their experts sit down and talk to us, and the first note on this, my notes from this meeting was that it's not absolutely necessary to have storage. That's the first thing. You can do 11 times cheaper if you just have a lot of extra generating capacity with the wind and solar. That's amazing.
And the biofuels. Well,
Where
do you see biofuels playing on top of wind and solar?
Well, there's another area where you can have storage. See, a lot of people think, well, you got to have hydrogen as a storage because, you know, obviously batteries are still too expensive. You can have hydrogen as a storage. Well, the Germans aren't going that direction. And I think a lot of the Europeans aren't going that direction either. What they're talking about is methanization. And that is where you can take hydrogen, create hydrogen with the electricity. It's a very inefficient process. But, you know, if you've got surplus generation, you don't care how efficient it is. You take that and you increase the carbon. You add carbon to it so you get methane. And methane, of course, we can put in a pipeline. And it's a lot easier to transport. We know how to handle methane. You methanize the hydrogen to produce through the electrolysis. So that's where the Germans are spending a lot of time, intellectual fervent and money, and researching is how to methanize hydrogen production and store the methane in, just the way we store methane now in underground caverns near our cities.
Well, but methane, of course, is a very serious greenhouse gas.
Yes. Well, we don't want to produce any more than we absolutely need, and the objective, of course, is to have gas-fired power plants so that we only use them a few hours a year, and that's where we want to go.
So what you're saying is we take we take electricity that's produced renewably.
Right, and then we make hydrogen, and then we zap
water and create oxygen, which actually oxygen has industrial uses.
That's right.
And hydrogen. And then we...
methanate it. We add,
How do we methanate hydrogen? What do we do there?
We add a carbon to it so that it becomes CH4 instead of just H2.
We don't just feed it manure. We put carbon in there.
Well, we can add carbon to it anyway. The challenge is how to do that on an industrial scale. And, you know, we've got the time to do the research, but we got to do the work now. You just can't that finds it, well, it's all going to happen. That's a problem we have here in the United States. We just throw up our hands and say, well, the future will come. Well, the future doesn't come. We build the future we want. And that's what the Germans are doing today. You know, the United States used to be known as a can-do country. In fact, during World War II, we fought the Germans, and we won. The Allies won, in part because we had a can-do attitude. We had an attitude, we'll just get the job done. Well, if you go to Germany today, they're more American than we are. They're more Jeffersonian than we are.
Uh-huh.
And they have an attitude, well, okay, let's just do it. And if, for example, if you talk to a utility engineer in Denmark, you'd think with all those windmills and stuff, as soon as you talk to the engineer about how to manage all those windmills, you'd think the guy would throw up his hands and say, oh, it's just terrible, terrible, all these windmills, the wind's always blowing and it's not blowing. And they just say, that's what I'm paid to do. I studied engineering to solve problems.
Yep.
I like solving problems. Okay, so I've got a challenge. Well, keep me busy, keep me occupied. I'm doing what I was trained to do. Instead of the attitude saying, oh, this is terrible, oh, you know, the kind of whining that we see so prevalent here. There's an attitude that's different, and I think we need to regain that, and I think we as Americans can regain that, and I think we'll be proud once we do.
Well, Paul, you've participated with the construction of quite a few windmills and the solar panels, I guess. Are you affiliated with any specific company right now?
No, I work independently.
So you work independently of the government and of business?
Oh, certainly of the government. I'm afraid the many governments would not have anything to do with me. Yes.
Well, I'm sure the Danish government would, the German government would. I don't know about hear about the Americans, but your talk of the integrated grid here also has serious implications for the utility industry and the way it's structured and the centralization of our power. Now, my understanding is that the utility industry in Germany has really been undercut in far more than expected by the spread of renewables, and that the renewables are actually far more community-based than was expected when this transition started.
Well, this goes back to our earlier conversation, Harvey, when I said much of the new the renewables that have been built are not owned by the utility companies. They're owned by people. They're not even owned by corporations. They're owned by cooperatives and small groups of people. And this has cut the lifeblood out of the electric utilities, and that's why electric utilities here in North America and Canada and here in the United States are fighting so viciously against renewables. When you read some article that says, oh, renewables, we can't do it here because whatever the excuse may be, I can almost guarantee you that those pieces have been placed by either the coal industry or the nuclear industry or by the electric utility industry itself, because what they see happening in Germany, they'll be damned if they let that happen here, because it means the death of the electric utilities as we know it. It means that we can own the generation. We can own it for our own benefit and our own profit. Doesn't mean electric utilities as an institution for managing the grid go away. We need those engineers. We need those technicians. They should be paid a fair price. They should be paid a fair salary and have retirements. And we should be glad they're out there doing the job, but we don't need the electric utilities to be building the power plants.
Wow. We're talking with Paul Guy. Paul, I'm going to ask you if you have time to come back next week, because I want to go deeper into that. Can you join us next week for part two?
I'll try to, Harvey, okay?
Okay, same time, same place. We've been talking with Paul Guy. There's so much more to go into on the renewable revolution. Paul is the author of a major article at nukefree.org, several books, A True Natural Resource. Paul, I hope to talk to you next week. This has been a really rapid Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show, and we'll see you again on the radio. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Harvey. Bye now.
Well, we bit the apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn.